Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organizational studies, brought to you with the support of the University of Sussex Business School. This is episode 46, which features a live recording from a professional development workshop on classics in organizational and management theory, held at the 78th annual meeting of the Academy of Management in Chicago. To learn more about the event, please visit our new website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. This workshop was intended to raise interest towards classic authors and ideas in the field of organization and management theory. So, it echoes the goal of our podcast to disseminate ideas about organizational theory with a special focus on the classics. The rationale for the workshop is that our field, although relatively young, seems sometimes more attentive to disruptions than continuities, novelty instead of tradition. So we hope too that the workshop would help making us more aware regarding connections between earlier and current scholarship, and enable us to explore how ideas, concepts, approaches from the classics, broadly understood, might better equip us to understand current affairs. The workshop included four senior scholars, and each one of them presented about the work of an author they believe is important for organization and management theory. The audience was made up of participants from the Academy of Management annual meeting. We were oversubscribed this year, so apologies for those who could not be included in the event. The good news is that you can now listen to the presentations from the workshop. Also, we are already planning the next year's workshop for the Academy of Management 2019, in which we hope to accommodate a larger crowd, and that workshop will probably focus on contingent theory, so stay tuned for news about that. The third speaker was Siobhan O'Mahony, who is an associate professor at the Boston University in the Strategy and Innovation Department. Siobhan concentrated on the work of Mary Parker Follett, an American who was a very important voice in classic organizational theory, and who, besides being a management consultant, was also a social worker and a philosopher, and lived between 1868 and 1933. To learn more about Follett, you can also check episode 4 in our podcast, in which we explore her text entitled The Giving of Orders.
This is actually a perfect sequence, because I think Mary Parker Follett was also pragmatic and I'll explain why I think I can do that. So Mary Parker Follett, some people know her really well. She probably doesn't have the reputation she deserves. And some people don't really know her at all but think they do. So I found a lot of misinformation about Mary Parker Follett, which is interesting. So she's not a founder of scientific management. She found the principles of scientific management abhorrent. And she kind of railed against it. She was a voice against Taylorism, against viewing workers as tools, as hogs. And she was not actually a management consultant. She was very much sought after by the day from politicians. Theodore Roosevelt read her dissertation from Bradford and called it a must-read. So she had a great influence through her writings and through her speeches. And people called on her to discuss the problem. And actually, in that case, the FDR wanted to talk to her about the problem of organizing voluntary associations at that time, and probably where they're going to deal with it. So she wasn't just a creator of poopy slogans. If you go on the web, you'll find a lot of stuff. Like, she said she had a very concise way of speaking, and she has some lovely pithy comments, like, management is the art of getting things done for people. And some of these pithy comments you'll see in various beautiful posters. But that's not really who she was. Who was she? She was actually, like many people at the time, had different identities. But first and foremost, she was a social worker. Worked in Roxbury, which even today is not the best part of Boston. Most of you live there. And she was helping create vocational centers for people who maybe weren't on the right track. So that is, I think, kind of this, she would observe, and she was, the way she worked, very practice hands on. She was trying to help people get jobs, trying to help people improve their lives, and a great studier of the group and the individual. And then she'd take those observations and remember them, and then come up with ideas, and then actually go out and go and practice it. So in a way, her daily practice, she was a social worker for 22 years, her daily practice was iterative over and over, writing and thinking and observing and watching what people did. So if I treat people like, I told you to do this and I expect you to do this, then they only do that. If I go the next day and I say, I'm sure you can figure this out, then they can surprise you and do so much more. So she was really practicing what she preached, and she worked in the lab, and the lab was the work of community organizing in the communities. So she was a founder of participative management pre-Mayo. And some of the great participative managers, they don't give her the credit they should, but it is evidence that they read her. So I'm going to say about that. She also had a great reputation in field conflict management. So having taught negotiations in an association department for a few years, I actually think the reputation is more solid in that field of mediation and conflict resolution. But Peter Drucker calls her conflict management. So there's a great collection of readings put together by great collection of readings so people reflect on Mary Pascal and wondering, like, why doesn't she have the reputation that she should? And Peter Drucker did not think that her gender stood in the way. But Rosabeth Moss Kantor offers a more nuanced explanation. She basically said, if you think about it, she wasn't in industry, so she wasn't kind of a titan in this, she didn't have that infrastructure to carry on and create a legacy. And she wasn't in academia, so she didn't have doctoral students and other students helping her refine her ideas. She was kind of in the Obama style of a real practitioner in the communities. So in a sense, she didn't have the infrastructure that would have given her the leg up to create the legacy that she is deserving of. So I'm going to submit that quite possibly she's the misunderstood mother of systems. And I'll tell you why I think that is. So the two main disciplines that she moved in, it's very interesting following this, conversations and how scholars have common. Her main fields were political science and management. And she moved between government, law, she theorized about democracy. Her dissertation looked at the influence tactics of speakers and consuls. She wrote about business and society, about leadership, power, authority, and English. But what people tend to remember her about is the story of all right, so in negotiation field, people remember her for this very clear and crisp articulation of how to deal with business, right? Well, there's domination. Management dominates workers. In that side, in that scenario, only one side gets what they want. There's compromise. And whereas before, I think, the field of conflict mediation viewed compromise as an optimal solution, she really disagreed with people of that notion. She's like, compromise is the worst because neither side. What you really want is integration, where you find a new way to integrate interests that are divergent, create a third solution. This is the best articulation. It's maybe you've heard Mary Parker and the Orange. All right, so in the story of Mary Parker Pollen and the Orange, there are two sisters fighting over an orange, and the mother says, "Stop this fighting, I'm going to cut the orange in half, and we each get half." Well, if she had probed for the underlying interest, she would have found that one sister had a recipe that required orange peel, and the other sister had a recipe that required orange juice. And if she had simply asked, what do you need the orange for, both interests could have been 100% met, versus by slicing the orange in half, neither side was able to make the recipe. She tells the story also with regard to the window. Somebody wants the window open or the window closed, and they're fighting over the breeze, fresh air versus the draft. And her solution is open the window in the next room. So she, right, so we get breeze, but I don't have draft. And she had a great belief in the deep probing of what people's needs really are should surface integration of different interests and could resolve conflict in a way that both parties would be satisfied. So I think this is where Kent and Maria finds her to be a bit Pollyanna. Maybe he is suspicious that this will always work. But her examples and her practice is compelling. And this kind of motto, the differences in the material to work with to create solutions that can satisfy people. She makes this really keen observation about differences in creativity that everything is beautiful, polished, comes from friction. Right? Polishing a stone, stone, especially some friction or difference, shouldn't be a surprise, shouldn't be unexpected. It's actually the material by which things become better, become more polished, and become more robust, possibly. So that's kind of what she's known for, but her real focus was much broader. And this is really interesting for me to kind of get back into. She really wanted to understand how individuals could be optimized within the context of groups. We've got group theory, group focuses on groups, and we've got kind of psychology over here. What we care about is the productive life. The first half of the productive power of the collective life is its nourishment of the individual. So she didn't want to see the individual lost through groups. So if you think about it as a practice of work as a social worker, she's trying to help individuals in a group setting. So she had a very good sense of this. The second test is whether the contributions of individuals can be implemented. And here you see the seeds that Paul Boris is very frank about in terms of disaggregation and integration. And Paul credits Mary Parker Follow as really sharpening his thinking in the need for both. We have to separate things so people can do their own thing and we can figure out how to bring them together. And he's very modest. Humbly says, you know, it's clear when you read Mary Parker Follett on integration that how much she influenced her aspect. So, very simple, her motivating question is how can individuals maximize their potential in the context of groups and organizations? And she wanted to figure out a way, a method by which individuals could be realized in a way that was in line with social norms. So, this is an ambitious aim, a little different from Marx. but my favorite kind of why I think she may be the mother of systems theory is she was, and also this is interesting, why she was underappreciated by her male colleagues. She was kind of railing not only against principles of scientific management, but also simplistic psychological theories at that time that believed human behavior was a straight function of the environment. Like we're just reacting and we're just receptors to things that are going on in the environment. And she had a very more complex formulation. And I don't think her colleagues appreciated the complexity. But here's the thing, we now have the tools to do this. What she was saying is that behavior is not a function of the environment, but is a function of the relation between itself and the environment. So France is not reacting to Germany, but France is reacting to its relationship. So this function of my relation with the environment really requires a system view. And there was no real method at that time to take this complexity and make it operational. So, and I think there's some writings I came across where the colleagues are finding, oh, that's very interesting. They're too complex for us to really unpack. So what she's really saying is that, you know, if this boy goes to school, school can change the boy. And there's this relationship between the boy and the school. And he's not just reacting to school, but the relationship that's emerging from school. So beyond the effect of organism on the environment on organism, organism responds to the relation between itself and the environment. Any analysis of behavior which does not take that into account would be man. So she's also very clever coming up with words, and she talked about what she meant is when you get to the situation, it becomes what it was plus you. You are responding to the situation plus yourself, the relationship with it. So she coined this term plus the clever, but not reused very much. She equated this to thinking about compound interest. So she was like, it's very naive for you to think about this unilateral relationship and yourself. It's kind of like you're adding up money without taking into account compound interest. So actually, kind of got through her thinking. So, but what she really wanted to do was create this kind of model which compounded the evolving relationship with its behavior in much the same way you would to create compound interest. So she's like, I don't respond to a static environment, but a changing environment, and my environment changes what I'm doing with that. And that function may be continuously monitored. So it is complex. And I think people over there are like, yeah, this is too over my head. So she is interested in this compounding effect of how you engage with your environment, how that continues to change. which is really a very early articulation of systems. So in practice, these are things I think where she kind of did that on participatory management. Treat people like they can solve their own problems. She had this idea of the law of the situation. If it's raining outside, people will get an umbrella. She has a lovely kind of everyday example in the right. Like, if you tell people just to do what they're doing, they're going to do that. If you treat them like more, you'll get more, basically. So I was thinking about how we might take her more seriously with our research design. I'm thinking that if she was alive today, that we'd have the tools to trace out the specific response in which she had imagined it. And she viewed behavior as three elements. What a person is doing, what a person thinks he or she is doing, and what a person says he or she is doing. And I mean, like, how would this influence our methods? I can see a lot of papers where we only look at one of those. Maybe sometimes two, right? Where people do compare what they say and what they do. But what if we were to take her seriously and think about methods that give us access to all three of those and to really understand behavior and its reciprocal effects? How could we triangulate among these sources of data? How can we understand the way people respond to the perceived relation? So what we think is going on is affecting them. I think she would have logged the data, but she would still talk to people. I think she would be really interested in what simulation might be able to do in terms of how people's interactions with the environment changes through that interaction in an iterative way. She would love to triangulate, I think, between observation and experimentation. I think she'd be really excited about system theory. I think it'd be really interesting for her to see how participative management has influenced the creation of, well, it influenced jobs that are in knowledge management area. But particularly disappointed that those practices that were started with Mayo, popularized in the 80s, quality symbols, things like that, nobody's even talking about those in jobs that aren't white collar. And that's disappointing. I think that would be discouraging. I think that would be where she would be